Hello, I'm Eric Topol, Editor-in-Chief of Medscape, and I've really got a special privilege here to have a conversation with Pardis Sabeti. She's an extraordinary scientist and physician at the Broad Institute and Harvard Medical School, and we're going to talk about her whole arc from moving here at age 2, is that right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And that was from Tehran to where?
We came here right around the Iranian Revolution, and so we came to the United States. We have refugee status here. But then moved to Hawaii, then New Jersey, then Georgia, then Florida, then around and about, and then but settled in Florida.
At one point, you weren't sure whether you were going to be own a flower shop or be a novelist or a doctor or something like that.
That was more like when I was 6 or something like that.
So I wasn't sure.
Yeah, okay. I just like flowers a lot, so I thought this seems like the life. That's what one should do. And as a kid, I liked to write a lot. But as an immigrant and as a kind of child of revolution, we were sort of given, my dad kind of amused himself by saying you can be anything you want in the world, a lawyer or a doctor.
Okay.
And so my sister became a lawyer, I became a doctor, but neither of us practice.
Wow. Now, also, music has been a big part of your life. When did that get rooted?
So that was actually not till grad school.
Oh, okay.
Interestingly, I liked music my whole life, and I played a little piano as a kid, but it wasn't really something we did so much of. But I just loved music, like concerts all the time. That was the way I enjoyed spending my time. And when I was in grad school, I had two friends who were in grad school with me, Americans, that we were all in England together. And they would fantasy band all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, we'd go to concerts, and then they would talk about makeup band names and all this kind of stuff. And one night I said, like, why do you keep fantasy banding? Why don't you just start a band?
Yeah.
And they said, we have to have at least a rhythm section. So the next day I bought a bass, and that
wow.
started my journey.
Now, I understand even these days you're a lead singer and writer for a rock band. How often do you get involved with that?
It wanes and waxes. It's not really like that conducive with faculty life, but I kind of dropped it for a while, and then I had a life event, an accident, and
yeah.
then suddenly started picking it up again. So I find music one of those things that's just great to do because every once in a while your just soul wants to speak and you have an opportunity to do it. So it's pretty sporadic how it happens, but
yeah.
been writing some recently.
Great. Now, somehow or other you land at MIT.
Well, so the reason I went to MIT was actually in sixth grade. The idea got sparked, and it was that my teacher in our like math class showed us a 270 competition, which is the competition where you build robots. And compete. So this mechanical engineering department has this competition where everyone competes building robots against each other. And so I just saw that video as a kid, and I'm like, I need to be there. I don't know where that world is, where people
So that was it?
That
wow.
was it. That
so
was it.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was locked on to MIT as like my dream school since then.
And you also then became a Rhodes Scholar and went to Oxford, right?
That's right. It was a bizarre experience, spending your right after college in this wonderland that was Oxford, and a lot of existential crises that happened right after college happened. But it was a really formative, great experience to do.
Were you already starting to get into the whole selection and mutation and evolutionary biology by then?
No, I think that's what made that happen. So I went to MIT, and I loved all the engineering and all of that, but I still thought what I was supposed to be is a doctor, and so I was intending to go to medical school, but got this scholarship sort of on a lark, and was already planning to go to medical school when I came back. But along the way, somehow ended up getting a PhD. It was sort of an interesting experience there, that they have shorter PhDs and kind of you can kind of just fall into that track. And so that's when I started doing that work, and it changed the direction of my life.
And then you went to medical school.
I did, yeah.
Wow, okay. So
which I'd already planned on doing.
Yeah,
Well, yeah.
Went through with it, which is a big commitment, of course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right, so now you're starting your career. You got this quite a pedigree background, of course. And did you ever know you were going to be leading the charge to do genomic epidemiology of Ebola and Zika and all these things?
No, I mean, definitely not. Since I never really intended to be a scientist, I didn't have a very specific path of what I wanted to do. And so I've really been kind of going wherever the clues. I feel like I'm on a scavenger hunt. I don't know exactly where it's going, but this has definitely been a path that's captured my attention for some time.
Well, this is quite the hunt. Just what you did in Ebola, you were named a Time Person of the Year in 2015, one of the most 100 influential people in the world. You went to West Africa with your folks in your lab and, of course, many other people that you work with to try to get control, the knowledge that was needed to titrate this horrendous epidemic. So can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, like, sure. I mean, for one thing, you know, just say is I'm just one bit player. In the end of the day, the Ebola fighters were recognized for the work that we all did collectively, and I, you know, was privileged to be one of the people that was used as an example. But it really was it was that collective effort. And to us, seemingly small part that we played was just that we naturally, coming from the genomics world, I cut my teeth on things around the Human Genome Project, where sharing data was sort of just a given, and this sort of open feeling of science. And so this is an outbreak we found ourselves in the middle of just because it came to the site where we work in Africa. And as we were trying to do what we could to help our collaborators there and our partners there, and to get attention, we started publishing science on this, and we started releasing our data to the web. And so I think that what was interesting is we decided we didn't care about getting recognition and just wanted to get data out to the world, and paradoxically, that's what got us attention, was it was so apparently unusual in that case to share your data openly as soon as you generated it, that it became sort of a call to the community.
You were scientists putting your lives on the line to do this work. What was that like?
You know, to be honest, as a scientist, that is the risk you take. We've been working on Lassa fever for some time. I've been quarantined before. We have risks that we put in place, but they're very measured risks. They're very calculated risks. And fundamentally, it's the clinicians. In all cases in our studies, it was the clinicians that became infected, and we see that across the board in the outbreak. So to us, actually, the researchers, we have a very contained environment that we can work in, and we can isolate things very, very well. So we're really at the service of the clinicians. We take risks, but a lot of the risks, there's more risks of being in a car crash in those countries than getting Ebola for us. And so we're just honored to be there to really support them.
Now, more recently, you've been involved on the Zika virus story. And where do we stand with that?
Well, Zika is different in the sense that Ebola was a rapidly escalating outbreak. It was one of those viruses that can transmit from human to human with very acute infections. And has very high fatality rates. So it was a very different kind of frightening event. Zika is, you know, less fatal, doesn't transmit as easily, and usually involves mosquitoes. But it's a more challenging thing to sort of battle. It's more widespread. Mosquitoes are, you know, hard to manage. The virus itself is sort of hides itself a little bit. It just is at very low concentrations in your blood and for short periods of time, and so diagnosis is challenging. But it becomes a really important thing, particularly because of the effects it can have on pregnancy and on children born to mothers that have Zika. Obviously, it has a real visceral reaction for us, and it's a very vulnerable population we all care about.
Now, back in 2015, you gave a TED Talk on how are we going to deal with the next deadly virus. Can you kind of summarize what you were transmitting at that time?
Yeah, so that was pretty heavy in the middle of the Ebola outbreak, and I'd been asked to give this talk at TED Women, and I just gave what was on my mind at the time, and it wasn't, you know, wasn't really thought out about exactly what message, and I didn't really know necessarily that it would go online. So I sang even in that when I gave the talk in the room.
Wow.
It was good in the room, but they sort of wanted to cut it down, you know, and make it the right length. But yeah, I just had fun with it, and the message was really about outbreaks and how frightening they are, but how you actually, it's a war that you win, but you win by collaboration. Very different from other types of threats to humanity. And it was really that's what I felt is the power of human capacity and human love to overcome these kinds of challenges.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the things I really wanted to underscore in our chat, and that is that what you've assembled, this global collaborative engine that is just exquisite because of the real-time sharing of data in this Sherlock investigation of what is the mutation of the virus that's accounting for its movement and its. So we have this, through sequencing, we have this remarkable tool, but it's, if it wasn't for the fact that you could assemble all the people and the parts and around the world, yeah. It might not work too well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have great people in my lab who are just incredibly collaborative. At every point, we think about how to reach out to others. And it was fun, actually. A lot of those collaborations happened when we released our data to the web. And some of the greatest leaders around the world just reached out to us and said, was this a mistake? Like, did you want to release this? And we said, no, please play with it. And that's how collaborations form. I think historically the community has been very siloed and competitive, but when you just, there's a coalition of the willing that have been begging, I think. It seems like it's like as soon as we did it, everyone was like, there's a group of people that really glommed on and were excited to have this opportunity to work together.
Well, I just have to say, not working in this space, it's just been an inspiration because I've never seen the effusive sharing and the rapidity. I've never seen anything like it, and so globally distributed. So a new model as far as I can see. I wish we could do that across the board in all the research in medicine. So you are quite young, and you have accomplished quite a bit. You have a NIH Innovator Award, and you've got a lab of, 34 people, and you got a lot of things going on. So where do you go from here? What is the next phase of your career?
Well, I think that there's a lot to do in outbreaks, and we're really just scratching the surface. We're really actually kind of at this point just identifying the problem. But we need we're at a really exciting place where the technology is there that if we leverage it the right way, we can have a powerful network that can respond very quickly. And so I'm dedicated to that. I think that's something I really want to do for a long, long time. And I'm dedicated to the students in my lab. I love my job. I love what I do. And then, I don't know, I've moved around. That scavenger hunt has taken me to a couple. I've got other projects I'm interested in that I won't go into too much. But throughout my career, I've gone into areas where it's sort of the unexpected happens, or I'm not necessarily chasing the next obvious big thing. I try to just go into some. Lassa fever was a virus nobody knew about, but I felt strong about it. So there's a couple of those kinds of little puzzles I want to solve.
Do you think you'll get involved with this whole notion that we should be using sequencing early to diagnose infections routinely?
We're already doing it. Yeah. So Mike Wilson gave a great presentation this morning. We're doing very similar stuff over in Boston in our clinic, and we're seeing it already. We've diagnosed a number of cases through a research approach, but well in advance of clinical diagnosis.
And so you're almost ready to start using that clinically, would you say?
I think that there's still things to be in place, but it's powerful data, and if we're doing it, we're creating a kind of CLIA lab, and we're mm-hmm. rolling that work
out. Oh, wow.
So yeah,
great.
And I think that's important. It's happening across the country. Is the research centers that do a lot of sequencing are trying to create that ability to do that.
Do you see the day where MinION little sequencing USB sticks will be done and sequencing in the remote parts of the world and somehow getting that data through the internet to find out the bug that way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the MinION is a really powerful model, and obviously all of these things need to continue to advance, but we see that we're, the genome technology is far exceeding Moore's law, and it shouldn't be too long until we all have one in our house. And frankly, no one should ever go to you should never go to a hospital if you have an infection, because it just becomes a cesspool and
right.
Of you getting another infection. So eventually it will kind of be at that point, but even if we could just now get them into main clinics and big cities, that would make a big difference.
Well, George Orwell called the hospital the antechamber to the tomb.
Yeah.
And he didn't even know it was because of nosocomial infections. You know?
Right, right.
So I'd love to talk to you for hours, and I know the folks that are listening are very intrigued because you've done so much to change the face of medicine in these global epidemics. And we're indebted to you, and not only that, but, training so many fine people. So we're really thrilled to have had a chance for the people in the medical community to get to know you. Because there's not many people like you, Pardee. So I want to say thank you for joining us, and thanks to everyone listening. This has been a fun discussion, and I think we'll be hearing a lot more from Pardee's in the years ahead. Thank you.